From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in this morning's second hour, an experimental program designed to treat Alzheimer's patients actually reversed memory loss in some study participants. That's according to recently published results in a small clinical trial by UCLA and Marin's Buck Institute on Aging. Researchers called the results encouraging, but said they were preliminary and would require further study. We'll talk about those findings and other recent developments in Alzheimer's research, which are also looking to many to be quite encouraging. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Alzheimer's and other dementia affects over 5 million Americans, and with baby boomers aging and the inevitable so-called silver tsunami up ahead, those numbers are expected to continue to rise. In fact, they're already rising since the numbers continue to grow, but hope too is rising for Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia, and that's our focus for this Forum Hour. Joining us in studio is Dale Bredesen, director of the Mary S. Eaton, Easton Center for Alzheimer's Disease Research at UCLA, professor there, and also Buck Institute for Research on Aging in Marin. He was founding president and CEO of Dale Bredesen. Welcome back to Forum.
Thank you, Michael.
We also want to welcome Leonard Mookie, who is director of the Gladstone Institute for Neurological Disease and professor of neurology and neuroscience at University of California, San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
And we'll also welcome Elizabeth Edgerly, who is chief program officer of the Alzheimer's Association, also head of the Medical and Scientific Advisory Council. And she runs the annual Researcher Symposium at the Alzheimer's Association. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Glad to have you all here. And I'm going to begin with Dale Bredesen, who's been getting a lot of attention for actually reversing memory loss for the first time. This is a personalized and comprehensive study done in conjunction with the Buck Institute and UCLA, and very small, we should add. But also getting a lot of attention because people thought, really, this couldn't be done. Let's talk about just what you're doing here. It's a program that's 36-part therapeutic, so there's a lot to talk about. But let's talk about the results first.
Right. So imagine, if you will, for a moment that you have a roof with 36 holes in it, and the drug company comes along and tells you, we're going to patch one hole really, really well. It doesn't help you that much. And so the idea is that if you look at the entire network that is involved in plasticity, and a number of the things involved with Alzheimer's play key roles in plasticity. We know that. So the idea was, could we patch all the holes? And then, interestingly, not only do you see improvements in patients, but also we believe that this will, in the long run, be a good platform for drug development, where you take a specific drug. Now you can really see if it's doing what it's supposed to be doing because you've patched the other holes. And I have to say, seeing the patients has been really dramatic. Seeing people get their memories back has been very exciting.
It is exciting. It's exciting, particularly for those of us who are trying to look with the periscope and think what might be laying in wait for us or for our parents and so forth. But this is such a varied program. I mean, a lot of it's diet, a lot of it's lifestyle, even oral hygiene, no gluten, meditation. I mean, the sort of things that skeptics might look at and say, hey, wait a minute, whoa, hold up here.
Yeah, we've had a lot of people laughing and saying, oh, it's just this, it's just lifestyle, it's just this, it's just that. It's not any one thing. The idea is, and this came out of the test tube. I mean, we've been working for 25 years in the test tube to understand the underlying mechanisms of neurodegeneration. And the surprise came several years ago when we realized that what we were studying in the test tube really fits quite well. My wife is a family practitioner. She's been telling me for 20 years that, you know, whatever you end up with in this disease is going to have something to do with diet and exercise and stress. And I laughed and said, no, it's going to be one specific gene. It's going to be one mechanism. I should have listened to her 20 years ago. She was on the right track. So, yes, there are many different things that impact this as we age. And by the way, this is no different than what happens in osteoporosis in cancer, in type 2 diabetes. These chronic illnesses have imbalances in physiologically relevant pathways.
So this is a kind of an imbalance of nerve cells that are signaling, as opposed to all these sticky plaques that we've been hearing so much about.
Well, and right. And of course, the plaques are incredibly important. We all know that beta amyloid, at least, that makes the plaque, and obviously where Leonard has contributed so heavily over the years. These are, of course, very important. The genetics tell us that, as well as molecular biology, transgenic mice, many things. But they're not the end of the story. They're part of a much bigger story that has to do with a balance in plasticity.
And there are only 10 patients so far, so the scale of this is pretty small at this point.
We published the first 10, but we have others since then who have similar results. So, you know, what we need, of course, more patients. We need hundreds and then thousands and then millions, and we need more documentation, and that's what we're doing right now.
Now, there's lots of stuff out there, and we'll talk about it also with Leonard Mookie and with Elizabeth Edgerly, but the sense of, well, for example, we need to replicate a lot of these programs. And there was in the October issue of Nature magazine, there was this article about Alzheimer's in a Petri dish with a lead researcher, somebody from Mass General.
Right.
They're calling this a game changer and a paradigm shifter and all those kinds of things.
Yeah, and that approach will certainly help us with drug development. Of course, in that approach, what Rudy said basically was that when you have amyloid, you get the tangles, you get the tau. The big issue, though, is in a human being, why do you get the amyloid? Where does that start? Where does that come from? And that there's more and more evidence that that has to do with not just genetics, but with many lifestyle. And I should add, after we published this original report, I had hundreds and hundreds of emails, and a number of them actually said, I've been doing something similar to this. For example, a woman who wrote and said that she'd actually started a website on APOE4. She herself is homozygous. She began to have symptoms when she was 49. She actually tested herself on Lumosity and found that she was at the 35th percentile for her age group. She ended up, through seeing a number of physicians, et cetera, being on very many. In fact, she said her jaw dropped when she got to our table that had all the list of things on it because she'd been doing almost the same thing. She came back without further practice to 98th percentile on Lumosity, and she's doing extremely well. We're actually now working with her to bring this to many people who are APOE4 positive. As you probably know, there are 75 million Americans who are APOE4 positive, and somewhere around 30 million of these are destined to get Alzheimer's if we don't change anything. So
talking with Dale
problem.
Bredesen, who again is director of the Mary S. Easton Center for Alzheimer's Disease Research at UCLA and founding president and CEO of the Buck Institute on Aging. Let me just bring in a couple of other things, though, here, because a lot of this seems to converge, or a lot of it is sort of acting synergistically. There's a protein that rouses us from sleep now. Again, there was an article about this recently that I was looking at. There was also something back in March in Nature magazine about plaques, but also brain stresses response system. I mean, so many things seem to be performing a kind of composite here of moving us to do something about memory loss and dementia.
Absolutely. So this is a symphony, as you just alluded to. And so the question is, if you want your symphony better, do you just want the tuba to play louder? Probably not. You want all the instruments, you want all of them to play appropriately. And you're absolutely right. Sleep is a part of this. And in fact, most Americans, of course, don't get sleep. In our studies, a number of these people were getting 4 or 5 hours of sleep a night, not good for you. And as you just pointed out, very nice research recently showing that you actually have essentially an anatomical flushing effect during sleep. So it actually is quite important to get rid of the very things that you want to get rid of, things like beta amyloid, while you are sleeping.
Well, maybe a symphony, Leonard Mookie, but it's also a toolbox that's being filled in ways that we had not suspected. I mean, this is all very encouraging. And let's talk about tau. And I don't mean anybody should confuse this with the Tau, T-A-O. We're talking about T-A-U here.
Right. Well, I think, as you pointed out, this is a time of really unprecedented challenges and opportunities in Alzheimer's research. On one hand, we have many more people coming down with the condition because of the aging of the baby boomers. And at the same time, it's wonderful that research is filling the toolbox and that more and more targets have emerged. There are the amyloid proteins that build up to abnormally high levels that Dale already mentioned. There is the tau protein, which also also accumulates and aggregates in the brain. And there is APOE4, the main genetic risk factor for the disease. And I would agree with Dale in the sense that I think the disease clearly has more than one cause. We've learned about several of them, and it is worth going after all of the causes that are well established. The tricky part has been to translate these insights into effective therapies. And I think this process has taught us that it is absolutely essential to put anything that looks promising through rigorously controlled clinical trials. And some of the very promising treatments have failed at very late stages.
Talk about this, the trials going on with this brain protein that I mentioned?
So, for example, there are, you know, there have been many efforts to target the amyloid protein in the brain to either prevent its production or to purge it from the brain through immunotherapy. And I think these are very interesting and promising strategies that deserve to be pursued further, but they've turned out to be really tough to implement in many people without having side effects and, you know, achieving the appropriate dose in the brain and all of this. And I think deservedly so, but it ought to be complemented with targeting the tau protein or APOE4. I mean, at the Gladstone Institutes, that is a major effort, these two proteins. And I think I like the idea of thinking about combination therapy that Dale, I think, you know, is proposing here. The question is, of course, when one looks at the many different things one could target, if you allow me to make a car comparison. Of course, as a physician scientist working on cognition, I know that people are much more complicated than cars.
We've got a roof, we've got a symphony, we've got a toolbox, let's go to the automobiles.
Okay, so I'm going to go there. All right, so suppose you have a car that's kind of getting a little older, you know, and it has a serious problem with the transmission. Now, you can fiddle around with a tire all you want. You may get a slightly smoother ride out of it, but sooner or later that transmission is going to do you in. And if Alzheimer's disease is a very specific disease of the transmission, then, you know, turning a screw here and a nut there and so on may not matter unless it is somehow connected to the transmission. So part of the issue is to really do a lot more basic research to figure out how all these different nodes in this web that we're looking at are tethered together and relate to each other so that one can say, you know, if we're thinking about combination therapy, is it really critical to change that tire to affect the transmission, or should I rather focus on the electronic system of the car or some other aspect, you know?
Well, maybe overhaul the whole transmission.
That would be, you know, if we had that strategy, that would be great.
But this brain protein, which accumulates in the brain, that you've done a lot of work on, mm-hmm. Tau, it can be toxic, and it can almost spread like an infection, as I understand it.
That's right.
Which tells us a mm-hmm. lot more than we knew before, too.
Yeah, so previously, this particular protein called tau was thought to exist only within cells and never get out. And recent research has demonstrated that it actually has a life outside of cells and in between cells where it can shuttle from one to the other. And there is the notion out there at the moment that as the protein builds up and is sort of shed from cells, it can make its way into others and begin that process in a way that is self-perpetuating, so where it can kind of maybe creep through the brain from one region to the next.
Talking with Leonard Mookie, who is director of the Gladstone Institute of Neurological Disease and professor of neurology and neuroscience at University of California, San Francisco. There are drugs for tau. There are drugs for amyloid, too, aren't there?
That's right. So there are many more drugs or at more advanced stages for amyloid than for tau, although tau is being targeted by more and more academic centers and companies, as we've seen failures on the amyloid front. And so there are various ways of how you can go after tau. One thing that we're very interested in is to just lower the overall levels of tau because it's not so clear what particular form of it is detrimental. detrimental. There are ways to promote to prevent its aggregation, because it seems that when this sticky protein clusters together, that's a bad thing and can impair cell function. So there are aggregation inhibitors. And then there are some ways of how this protein becomes modified to either make it stick around for longer in the brain so it's not as easy to get rid of it. And that can be modulated with some drugs that are being developed at the moment. So I think there are many exciting entry points to go after that drug target.
This is the conclusion I came to in doing research for this program, how many again, exciting and new vistas there are in research. In fact, I was reading about drugs for epilepsy that actually restore meaning, memory in mice.
That's right. Yeah, so we identified a particular drug called levetiracetam, not an easy thing to say, that's used widely for epilepsy. And in very low doses, it had a beneficial effect in mice that simulate some aspects of Alzheimer's disease. So it made their cognition better and improved the brain cell function. And a colleague of ours, Michaela Gallagher at Johns Hopkins University, did a small trial with this drug in people with early stages of Alzheimer's disease, and also saw some benefits in that the drug reversed network dysfunction, as she visualized by brain scanning. And these people were also able to do a particular cognitive test better after even just 2 weeks of treatment. So we have a larger follow-on trial ongoing at Gladstone and UCSF at the moment. So we're actively enrolling patients in this to see if there is at least a subgroup of people with Alzheimer's disease that might benefit from this particular compound that may help stabilize network functions in the brain.
So, Elizabeth Edgerly, with all of these exciting new vistas and possibilities, it probably highlights all the more funding that we need. And there's a lot of disparity in funding.
Right? Absolutely. Absolutely. When you look at the money that we're spending, currently we're spending over $200 billion on the care for people with Alzheimer's and related disorders, in sharp contrast to the approximately $600 million we spend each year on Alzheimer's science. And what we're seeing is that it's hard for researchers like Leonard and Dale to get the funding they need to do the research that they're doing. And all of their young colleagues are struggling even more, I would venture. And so what at the Alzheimer's Association, we've been pointing out that this is in sharp contrast to other conditions like cancer and heart disease and HIV, which receive funding in the billions of dollars, and appropriately so. And so we're really pushing for increased awareness that we're spending just over $100 a year for each person with Alzheimer's on a treatment or a cure for Alzheimer's in the future, in contrast to thousands of dollars a year for the care of those individuals. And that has to change.
Well, we just did a program recently on medical errors, and there are those who say medical errors is the third biggest killer behind heart disease and cancer. But I suppose it depends how you reckon these things, because Alzheimer's probably, in many people's minds, the third biggest killer behind cancer and heart disease.
It's a major factor, and often it's not even documented. That's what makes tracking Alzheimer's so difficult. Is if you think about it, many of your listeners probably have family members who had confusion in old age, and it was never labeled as Alzheimer's. They just thought it was, you know, senility.
Dementia, senility, yeah.
It's what happens when you get older. And so for decades, Alzheimer's was invisible. And even today, if someone dies from pneumonia, for example, but Alzheimer's was the primary disease that they were living with, that often isn't documented properly. So we have this challenge of identifying Alzheimer's, and in more than 50% of instances, it is never diagnosed.
Well, it means that we need not only better detection, we obviously need earlier detection, but also emphasis on some of those pre-symptoms.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's one of the areas of research that I'm finding is of tremendous value, is that early detection. The idea that we could, in the near future, have a test like a blood test, where we could go in and say, you know, take my blood and then tell me if I have the precursors to Alzheimer's, and then ideally have a treatment like those that Dale described or Leonard described that could prevent me from progressing. That's a future that we could all say, all right, sign me up. I want to do that.
But why would there be usefulness in early detection if there's no treatment?
Well, they really go hand in hand. And that's the criticism often we get when we talk about early detection. But for us to get to the point where we can treat people before the damage is done, you have to have that early detection. And so most of the time we're talking to people who have memory loss already. And the prevailing view is that by the time you have memory issues and other issues, a lot of damage has taken place. And so that's why some of these new studies that are looking for people with other markers that indicate that they are potentially on this trajectory to develop Alzheimer's, that if we can identify those people and intervene with some of these failed treatments that Leonard was mentioning, some of the amyloid treatments or even these new tau treatments, if we could intervene early, perhaps we could lessen the damage.
Well, one thing we do know is that there are high-risk groups. For example, African Americans are higher at risk for Alzheimer's, and yet you've got cultural challenges. I mean, there's a whole stigma within that African American community about even talking about things that relate to Alzheimer's.
And we see that in other communities as well. In some communities, we see even more the prevailing view that Alzheimer's is normal aging. And so if you view it as something that is normal, you're very unlikely to go and get help for it, seek additional services or support for the caregiver or the person with the disease. And so we see this in many cultures.
Let's talk before we get into more detail here, I'd like to give out the number and tell you, our listeners, how you can communicate with us. I know that many of you are concerned about Alzheimer's, but we're talking about new avenues in Alzheimer's research and what can be done. And I know there are many of you who have questions and concerns, so please feel free to bring them to the fore. You may want to talk about the really exciting research that Dale Bredesen is doing and that Leonard Mookie is doing, or just about the whole question with respect to funding and what to do about Alzheimer's. We welcome your involvement in the program, and you can let us know what your thoughts are or join us with questions you might have now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Feel free to join the program by calling that number. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786. There are a number of other ways you can indeed join this conversation or join us with your questions or comments. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. Again, talking with Elizabeth Edgerly, who is Chief Program Officer of the Alzheimer's Association and heads the Medical and Scientific Advisory Council and runs the annual Researcher Symposium at the Alzheimer's Association. Leonard Mookie is also with us in studio this hour. He directs the Gladstone Institute of Neurological Disease and is professor of neurology and neuroscience at University of California, San Francisco, and Dale Bredesen, director of the Mary S. Easton Center for Alzheimer's Disease Research at UCLA, and professor and also Buck Institute for Research on Aging in Marin, where he was founding president and CEO. We'll find out what your thoughts are when we return. Just a quick sort of footnote here, Dale. Vascular disease, we've got seconds here. Again, talking about high risk, people are more at risk for Alzheimer's with vascular disease, yeah?
Absolutely. That's one of the contributors. And there seems to be a bidirectional flow here where there is a leaky vessel that seems to be important, leaky vessels in general with Alzheimer's. So vascular disease seem to contribute and be a part of the pathogenesis.
Find out what your thoughts are, your concerns, questions, and comments when we return on Forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our focus this hour is on Alzheimer's and dementia. There are new vistas, as I said, in terms of Alzheimer's research, and we're letting you know about these and letting you know about some really hopeful things that are on the horizon that are happening, and many of them converging. Elizabeth Edgerly with us from the Alzheimer's Association, and Leonard Mookie from the Gladstone Institute, and Dale Bredesen from UCLA and the Buck Institute. And we're going to go to your calls and emails. You can indeed join us by calling our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or posting any question or comment you might have onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. We're talking about a couple things, actually, off-air before I go to your calls and emails. We're talking with Leonard Mookie about public health and detection, and this is really an important piece of the puzzle here, or a piece of the ongoing attempt to do what needs to be done.
So as Elizabeth pointed out, I think, you know, there is a great need for earlier detection. And the question was raised, well, what if we, you know, don't have really effective treatments yet? What is the point in being tested? And I think there's a very important public health impact of this. In fact, I have somewhat jokingly said in the past that I would like to offer free testing for Alzheimer risk factors to the whole House and Senate, because maybe that will change the way Alzheimer's
disease frightening results too.
Is funded. Because so if more people knew, for instance, that they are APOE4 positive, which is the bad APOE that increases your Alzheimer risk, there may be a greater demand and pressure on funding agencies to support research that would lead to an effective treatment targeting APOE4, which we're sorely missing at this point. So I think there is this relationship between public awareness of personal risk and pressure exerted on those people who can decide on how much research goes on in this area.
I think we have a caller on point here. And PJ, you're on. Good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My father, who's passed away, was an Alzheimer's victim. My one sibling, my older brother, is currently Alzheimer's, somewhat advanced, and we think, unfortunately, now. And I'm just wondering, you've just hit the nail on the head here with this idea of this APOE4 testing, at least. But I think the populace, myself included, are woefully uninformed about how and where to get that done.
Elizabeth, can you help us here?
Yeah, and certainly it's something that you can approach your family doctor and ask. There's also diagnostic centers in Northern California that would be happy to talk with you about this. And potentially even there might be some clinical studies locally that you might want to consider. Many family members come to us in your exact scenario and say, how can I get involved? I'd like to see if I potentially also have, whether it's the APOE4 gene that Leonard was mentioning, or even getting some tests done to see if there are already changes in the brain. And there are studies locally recruiting. If you do that, they will do the testing for you. It used to be that you could just send off a sample and receive those results back in the mail, but last year that was certainly altered. So now you would have to go through your doctor, and we do recommend that you seek out genetic counseling if you possibly can, because you want to really understand the impact for you, and if you have other siblings or you have children, your genetic results will impact them as well. And so we do recommend people.
And there is also to be considered, though, the consequences that this testing might have for your ability to obtain long-term care insurance. I think we've seen some advances, positive advances in the legislature, but not all loopholes have been closed. So there is still the possibility, especially in relation to long-term care insurance, if
Absolutely.
I understand it correctly, that if an insurance company would know your APOE genotype, you may have a hard time getting this insurance. So, you know, I wish that we would have legislature that would prevent all such discrimination, I think.
So what we've talked with some people in this situation about is you can purchase the long-term care insurance first and then go and seek counsel. And many families do that. And often we talk about do what you would want to do if you knew you had the gene. Act in that way, doing the things like exercise and diet and taking care of yourself and purchasing perhaps long-term care insurance. And then you can find that information out afterwards and already have it in place.
As long as we're touching on this, let me go to you, Dale Bredesen. Listener writes, other than the well-publicized things like exercise, mental stimulus, things like crossword puzzles, staying social, etc., what does the current research indicate 50 to 60-year-olds should do to reduce or forestall this disease?
Well, there are many things, actually. Let me just take one step back to say because I think it's important. There's a new test that's coming out, and very interesting data published on this recently from Dr. Ed Getzel at UCSF on what's called neural exosomes. And he's looked at human beings over time and found changes. They're very interesting. These are small fragments about 100 nanometer fragments of cells that are derived. You actually have 1.2 billion of these things floating around for each cc of your blood. And what he found was that 10 to 15% actually derived from neurons. And he could see the same sorts of changes that you actually see in Alzheimer's patients. And the reason I bring it up is just because he could see these 10 years ahead of the diagnosis of Alzheimer's. So it's yet another, and this adds to the information we already have on scans and so forth, saying that, in fact, you can see the process for many years ahead. Now, as far as
what to do, spinal taps and PET scans and things like that?
Yeah, well, the good news is you don't have to have a spinal tap to have your exosomes evaluated. So it's just – it's a blood test. And I think it's something that we'll probably if the results hold up, we're probably going to see more and more of this over the next several years. As far as what to do, you bring up a really good point, and as Elizabeth alluded to, it turns out that the magnitude of the effect of one allele of the APOE, so one APOE4, is approximately equal to the magnitude of the effect of regular exercise. So there's a good trade-off there. There's no guarantee, but so that's one of the usual things. You mentioned the vascular things. There's an interesting study in Finland now called the Finger Study that's ongoing, addressing vascular parameters. A lot of things just to do with when you eat, how much you eat, whether you have a more of a ketogenic diet, whether you in fact have a lot of sugar in your diet, a lot of simple carbohydrates in your diet, whether you have trans fats in your diet, those sorts of things, whether you have a chronic inflammatory state. And there's more and more information that, in fact, inflammation is a critical mediator. And in fact, some of the things that actually mediate inflammation increase A-beta. It's more and more clear that A-beta is itself part of the inflammatory response. So resolving the inflammation over time is critical, and there are a number of ways to do this. So
and we should
many, many different parameters.
That Dale Bredesen's research is in the journal Aging, and you can read about this reversal of memory loss with these 10 patients that we alluded to in the beginning. We were also talking a little bit off mic about new research. We're talking about all these new vistas of research out of the UK that shows a link between schizophrenia and Alzheimer's.
So, it's very interesting. Alois Alzheimer's first patient certainly had some paranoid delusions also. And it's widely known that people who do develop Alzheimer's disease can also have sometimes misconception about reality and think that people are stealing from them. And
delusions.
All of those things, mm-hmm. delusions. And so there is an overlap clinically. And we also discovered some very interesting changes in Alzheimer brains that have to do with a particular type of regulator cell or master regulator cell that determines brain rhythms. So there are rhythms going on in our brain that we can record with EEGs, for example, electroencephalograms. And those brain waves are very critical for our cognition. And there are certain types of them called gamma oscillations that are especially important for cognition and for learning and memory, and they are impaired both in Alzheimer's disease and in people with schizophrenia. And it seems to be possible by cranking up the activity of these master regulator cells to improve the power of these gamma oscillations in the brain. This is work done so far only in animal models of the disease, but it looks quite promising. So we're hunting for drugs that can enhance the function of these master regulator cells to improve the brain rhythms. And that could be a treatment that might be of positive effect both in Alzheimer's and in schizophrenia and related conditions.
Well, as I said, they used to call schizophrenia dementia precox. I mean, there's some prescience there. Let me get to some more of your calls, and let's go next to Louisville, Kentucky. Dina, hi, you're on.
Hi, good morning out there. I used to live in the San Francisco Bay Area, but I'm originally from Kentucky here. When I called the Alzheimer's Association, they explained to me that Alzheimer's is just one facet of the 10 different types of dementia or Alzheimer's, and can you explain the difference between just dementia and Alzheimer's itself?
Important question, and thank you for it. Elizabeth Delgerly.
Yeah, absolutely. Hi, Dina. And that is by far the number one most common question that we get is, what is the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia? Dementia is really more of a general term that describes cognitive impairment in different areas. And most of us know about the memory impairments, but it's more than just memory impairments. It's language difficulties, judgment problems, issues with reasoning, even behavior changes, and perhaps even mood changes. And so when I hear that someone has been diagnosed with dementia, what it tells me is that their doctor is indicating that they're having some of these issues with their cognitive functioning, and it's in more than one area. It's not just memory or just language. And it also tells me that it's going to get worse over time. What it doesn't tell me is what is causing those symptoms of cognitive impairment and dementia. And so Alzheimer's is the number one cause of dementia. Everybody with Alzheimer's, at least today, has dementia. They go hand in hand. But not everybody with dementia has Alzheimer's. So as we talked about earlier, there are vascular changes associated with Alzheimer's. There's also a dementia associated just with vascular issues called vascular dementia. There's one called Lewy body dementia that's
It turned out Robin Williams had.
Yes, very tragically. And others called frontal lobe dementia and alcohol-related dementia. It's a very long list. The majority of people with dementia have Alzheimer's, but about 40% have something other than Alzheimer's.
Listener writes, did I correctly hear that there's a connection between gluten and Alzheimer's? I think, Dale Bredesen, gluten is in your 36-point program, or avoiding gluten. I got to tell you, I mean, a lot of people are off gluten entirely, and I think other than celiac disease, now this may be true about Alzheimer's, but I've never known it to be really that related to, except people who have allergies.
Right. If you have an extra 5 or 6 hours, Michael, we could go over the gluten connection. There's
a great new book, by the way. I love the title of it. It's called Scared Wheatless.
Yeah, it's great. And the point there was simply that there are many causes of inflammation, and chronic inflammation is unquestionably a problem in Alzheimer's. And so we minimize it with things like omega-3s and like curcumin and like eating the right foods. So my simple point was, if you are sensitive to gluten, and there are some wonderful tests out there now to determine that, then don't put your head in the sand. Find out about it and use that as one of the ways to reduce your chronic inflammation.
Well, we've got actually somebody wants to know where they can get more information on the 36-point program. In addition to the aging journal, the journal Aging, excuse me, is stuff online now?
So there are a number of things online, but there's also I'm working on a book on this to go through because, of course, you can't put everything in one paper. So there's a lot more coming out. We're also working on a follow-up letter to all the hundreds of emails that have come in.
Well, let me bring some more callers on, and we go next to a caller in San Francisco. Kathy, welcome. You're on Forum.
Oh, hi. I've been following a new sleep drug called Suvorexant, or I guess it will be called Belsomra, which was developed by Merck and is coming out early next year. It targets the orexin receptor, which I know Michael Krasny already mentioned as being of interest in Alzheimer's treatment. I haven't seen any mention of this drug as a potential in Alzheimer's treatment. So I'm just wondering if I've missed it or if there's something about this drug that targets the orexin receptor that for some reason they're not focusing on in Alzheimer's treatment. I'll take my comments
okay,
off the air.
Thank you for that call. Leonard Mielke?
So I'm unaware of this drug being assessed for treatment of Alzheimer's disease. And in fact, even though there is very clear evidence that there are major sleep disruptions in Alzheimer's disease that plague people and particularly the families, of course, with this condition, there has been very little in terms of targeting sleep hygiene and sleep in clinical trials for Alzheimer's disease. I think it is an understudied an area that deserves more attention.
Hasn't there also been some linkage between sleeping pills and anxiety, anti-anxiety drugs and Alzheimer's?
Yes, actually, there was just something a few months ago pointed out.
There's a thing
in
Time magazine about it.
You know, the thing is that there have been many of these things picked up epidemiologically, anesthetics, another one. And then there are also, of course, now things that are coming out of the screens that we're all doing, looking for. And you already heard Leonard's discovery with respect to the anti-epileptic. There's also something published recently on an antidepressant. So I think you're going to see more of this. There have been things in the past like melatonin where there have actually been trials. You know, the argument is that if we're looking for a combination, then you may end up seeing the multiple single things that by themselves have very modest effects but fail to reach clinical significance. And by the way, not terribly different than what was seen early on with HIV, where you have single drugs that don't make a big difference. When you get the right combination, it does make a big difference.
There's a listener named Zach who says, I care for my mom with Alzheimer's disease. By far the most powerful treatment has been using coconut oil replacement therapy, basically substituting coconut oil for the lack of glucose processing ability with the disease. With the addition of turmeric, saffron, sesame seeds, fennel seeds, and all these foods are the best treatment out there. So everybody's got an opinion on how to treat Alzheimer's.
So I think the great difficulty has been, you know, to really prove that this works on a large scale. And I'm certainly not aware of any rigorous, prospective, well-controlled trial that has looked at the effects of coconut oil on Alzheimer's disease risk. I think there is no such evidence that I've seen. And it has been incredibly difficult to predict the efficacy of drugs, even with fairly large, fairly well-controlled clinical trials. Many have failed when you then went into even larger trials. And so I think, you know, the belief is good, and, you know, there are lots of things that are worth trying, and some may even work in an individual case. But if you want to make recommendations on a large scale, the fear that I always have is that we have a whole bunch of people going out there and doing lots of things that are really not going to be of great value to them. And I think at a very minimum, I suggest that people do it under the very careful guidance of an experienced physician in Alzheimer care.
Here's a listener who wants to know if there's a relation between Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. If we have Parkinson's in our family, should we also worry or get tested for Alzheimer's risk? And I'd mention Robin Williams. He also had Parkinson's. So connection there, Dale, you know?
Yeah. So, in fact, if you look at the 1 million Americans who have Parkinson's and the 5.4 million who have Alzheimer's, in fact, there is a greater than random overlap. And, in fact, the neuropathologists will tell you that they often see the two together. As you pointed out, Robin Williams had Lewy body disorder, which is, to a first-order approximation, Parkinson's plus Alzheimer's. In other words, you have the pathology of the Lewy bodies, which have now spread in, you know, into the cortex, so beyond where they're typically seen in Parkinson's. And these people often present, as we were hearing earlier, they often present with the typical dementia sort of story, often misdiagnosed as Alzheimer's. And interestingly, they in fact often do have delusions and hallucinations and things like that that can tip you off to say that this is more likely to be Lewy body dementia rather than Alzheimer's.
We're getting, I think, a lot of questions like the one coming from Sandy in Novato. Sandy, welcome. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much for taking the call. My sister-in-law has been diagnosed with dementia, and we're wondering, we're in Novato, California, with the Buck Institute in the same city, and we're just wondering, who can we call or who can we get in touch with to get her involved in any of these clinical trials?
Dale Bredesen? Well,
yeah, I would actually recommend, since the Buck Institute is a basic research institute, probably the best place to go is the Memory and Aging Center, run by Dr. Bruce Miller at UCSF. I think that's an excellent place. Of course, you could also go to Stanford or other places. There's a brain health center at CPMC, for example. But I think that the Memory and Aging Center has proven to be an excellent place for evaluation.
Good luck to you, Sandy. You have something to add, Elizabeth Edgerly?
Yes. Also, there's a resource called Trial Match that the Alzheimer's Association has that has a comprehensive listing of all of the studies at each of the institutions that Dr. Bredesen just mentioned. And so if you go to ALZ.org and look for Trial Match, you'll be able to enroll. And then what happens is you're screened, or you're, I believe you said it was your sister or sister-in-law, would be screened and then matched up to say you can choose from these studies and then pursue ones that you could actually get into, because not everybody qualifies, if you will, for every study.
Elizabeth, you might be able to answer another listener question. This is one of our listeners who writes, my father had early onset Alzheimer's, which began in his late 40s. My sister is 50 and I'm 45. Are we candidates for screening for early detection of the disease? I fear that once the insurance companies are alerted to a possible positive outcome, we might not be candidates for health insurance. Please explain how early detection affects health insurance coverage. You alluded to this somewhat, but maybe in a case like this where there's even fear of going in for early detection.
Yeah, and it's especially scary when you're talking at such a young age, young onset. Alzheimer's does, unfortunately, sometimes have more of a link to a genetic cause. It's not always the case, but there are genetic mutations that are different from the E4 gene that we've been discussing often this morning. And in that case, certainly it is a concern. At this point, however, with regards to health insurance, you should not be discriminated against based on, say, having a genetic mutation and being then unable to get health insurance. That should not be the case. But as Dr. Mookie mentioned, long-term care insurance is different. And so at a young age, usually Alzheimer's is not going to be a big red flag for an insurer. However, in the thorough assessment they do, they may start asking about Alzheimer's in family members, and it is possible that then they might not sell you the insurance. And so it's hard to say. It depends on your situation and the provider that you're looking to. But I do encourage you to reach out, just like the last caller, if you wanted to see, are there studies recruiting people at a young age who might get involved? We do have some in Northern California that are looking at Alzheimer's, and sometimes in younger onset individuals or people who have a family history. So that might be something to pursue.
And we'll pursue more calls. We'll go next to Rebecca in San Jose. Rebecca, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I really appreciate it. Today happens to be the 2-year anniversary of my dad's death, and he died of pneumonia, but he had been, I mean, became almost like a vegetable because of dementia. And he was diagnosed when he was 52, and I was 16 then. And first of all, I just wanted to thank you guys for the research, and I wish that something was available to him. But also, I just wanted to comment that, you know, this disease is just, it is so gut-wrenchingly heartbreaking. And, I lost my dad long before he died. I felt like he died a little bit more every single day. And I'm just, it's just so, so sad and so painful. And so many people are experiencing this. And unfortunately, it's a disease that doesn't get a lot of hype and it doesn't get a lot of attention. So many of us will get it in some regard. And anyway, I just wanted to thank you guys for what you're doing. And I wanted to say that I, in September, swam Alcatraz and did that in my dad's honor to raise money for the Alzheimer's Association. And I wanted to see where my money would be best where I should be donating for more of this great research.
Well, first of all, sorry for your loss and congratulations on the swim. That's quite a feat to be proud of. Where money is best used? I mean, get some considered opinions from this distinguished panel.
Well, I think, there are many, many different ways of how one can put oneself behind the fight. I think there is, of course, as you mentioned, personal efforts to increase awareness. For example, the Alzheimer's Association's memory walk, I think, is one great thing to write to your senator or your congressman. I think is a great move. And then, of course, you can donate to the Alzheimer's Association or you can find a local center of excellence. Here in the Bay Area, the Gladstone Institutes, the Buck Institute, the UCSF's Memory and Aging Center, Stanford. There are lots of places. Best is to get to know the groups. You can go wider and get advice from the Alzheimer's Association that has their fingers on the pulse with respect to a lot of the research. So Elizabeth is a good person to contact, I would say.
Well, before we conclude, Elizabeth, you'll give out your website, but I want to get another caller on here who's talking about, well, to some extent dovetailing on what the last caller was mentioning, which is whole question, Alan, about public education, which is concerned to you. Yeah.
Yes, that's my question. You know, we know so much, according to Dr. Bredesen and others, about lifestyle change, diet, exercise, stress reduction, sleep. None of this is publicized by the Alzheimer's Association, Elizabeth, and I've gone through the Marin Alzheimer's office, gone over all the brochures. Nobody in your organization is putting out any information yet about these findings. I don't think it's too soon to do that, because every week you are reading about new discoveries on how to defer or prevent Alzheimer's. And the association does nothing but raise money for awareness of the illness itself once it's on you.
Now, let me hear from Elizabeth on that. Elizabeth,
thanks for your call. And it's not the first time I've had people asking about, well, what about the brain health message, and what can you say about this? And certainly there is a lot of evidence coming out, epidemiological evidence, where we're looking at populations and we're saying things like people who exercise seem to be less likely to develop Alzheimer's. People who are cognitively active seem to be better off than those who are not.
Can I just intervene here for 1 minute, because I'm looking at a comment from a listener who says, how do we explain Alzheimer's disease in someone who all throughout their life was incredibly active, ate very healthy, did many of the recommended things to do to keep the brain strong? I mean, that's
exactly it. That's it. And so we are a very careful organization. So we only share information when we feel very confident that it is backed by science. And as I know both of our panelists know, because they've been involved with us, we are cautious about what we say because of that very reason. And I know dozens, probably hundreds of people who did all of the right things and developed Alzheimer's.
This listener says, my grandmother is now in final stages of Alzheimer's, was incredibly active her whole life, well into her 60s. Where's the hope in leading an active lifestyle and your older age and eating healthy and not getting this disease? Well, we've been talking about new vistas here, new research, and I think that's where a lot of the hope lies. And we've come to the end of the program. I'd extend thanks to all of you for being here with us this hour. Dale Bredesen, who directs the Mary S. Easton Center for Alzheimer's Research at UCLA and is Buck Institute for Research on Aging founder and founding president and CEO. Leonard Mookie, director of the Gladstone Institute of Neurological Disease and professor in neurology and neuroscience at UCSF. And Elizabeth Edgerly, chief program officer with the Alzheimer's Association and head of the Medical and Scientific Advisory Council. Thank you all. Thank you, our listeners. Here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. And for all of us, KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.